there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than the last. I can't remember the last thing that she said as you were leaving, but the days go by so fast. Then it's one more day up in the canyon.
It's always amazing. That band, The Counting Crows, my wife and I saw that band in the early 90s at a seafood restaurant, playing at a seafood restaurant in Birmingham, Alabama. So every time I hear that song, I automatically think back to that experience. It's funny how music can kind of take you to a place. Ladies and gentlemen, it's William Tin Cup. Brian and Nisha are both in Norman, Oklahoma, with the kickoff of Oklahoma Sherm today. I'll be up there tonight, and I speak tomorrow. So all three of us will be in the same zip code, which is rare. But they're both off the show today and mixing and mingling. Make sure you pay attention to the hashtag for Oklahoma Sherm and follow that for the next couple of days. And I can't wait to get to our guest because I think he's one of the brightest minds in our industry, and he's got just a different take on things. So it's going to be a lot of learning for all of us. So, Glenn, why don't you do us a favor? First of all, welcome to DriveThruHR, and introduce yourself for us.
Hi there. Yeah, delighted to join you. Always enjoy our conversations. Hi, I'm Clinton Wingrove. I'm the Executive Vice President for PILOT HR Solutions. We're a human capital management consulting and technology company. And I also head up our consulting practice here in the US, as you can probably tell from the accent, as well as for our European operation. So delighted to join you, Bill.
And where is that accent from specifically? Where does it come from?
I was born in Kent in the United Kingdom, southeast UK. But I've never worked for a British company. Only ever worked for American companies or Israeli companies, and now happily a legal resident alien in the US. So I've been here for 12 years. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. But you get back and forth quite a lot.
Yeah. 50% of my time probably US, 50% of my time somewhere else. So, the wife rings up and asks where I am. So.
Wait a minute. Who are you? Yeah, those are the questions you don't want to get. Like, will they forget your name or your face? or anything like that. Clinton, you have, with all of your customers and the way that y'all have operated, you have an interesting perspective about HR, and I'd like to ask the question, what's your perspective on what's keeping HR up at night these days?
Yeah, for some, frankly, Bill, it's retaining their seat on the board. We've seen HR come under some serious attack with the recession, which I'm being assured we're starting to see ourselves coming out of in the US, although I think Europe's struggling and lagging well behind. So I think at the top level, many senior HR people are really being challenged to prove their worth. And I think, therefore, at the 50,000-foot level, I'm seeing most of them focusing on three things. How do we ensure within our companies we get more for less? How do we maximize discretionary performance? And I hesitate to use the word engagement because I think it's getting a little tired, perhaps, but it is about how do we maximize productivity? How do we get the best out of all the people we've got? Second thing I think is how do we maximize capability? We're beginning to realize we've got to grow from within, recruitment's under tight control, and we know that with the right leadership, with the right training and development, even the stunningly mediocre can significantly prove their performance if they acquire new knowledge and skills. And then I think the third thing is everybody's concerned now that the recession really is over and we're going to go back into that war for talent. So I think many of HR people are saying, how are we going to identify those absolutely critical people, and what are we going to do to keep them? So I think at a 50,000-foot level, that are three things I'm seeing. I think there's other things then at the next level down.
Well, are those, in your mind, are those equally weighted, 33%, or do you feel like there's one that occupies most of their mind right now, and then the other are tertiary?
We've seen a shift. I think the third one, you know, the retention, as always, the mind will be sharpened when the economy really has picked up and suddenly we're struggling. We have a horrible habit of leaving that one till the last minute. I believe that sort of maximizing the discretionary performance, most organizations have looked at that, although I still see some awful performance management systems. But I think a lot of companies are now you know, really grappling with the new socioeconomic structures, the new way in which companies work, and so on. The bit that I'm seeing companies getting really sort of concerned about, putting lots of brain power in, is how do we maximize capability? And typically that now is a critical component in, you know, the talent management review, looking at management continuity, looking at leadership pipeline, looking at how we're going to move people through the organization, career plans, and so on. And it's all coming round to, I often quote Winston Churchill. You know, he said in the Second World War, anybody can plan, it's carrying out the plan that's the problem. And, of course, in America, we help greatly with that. But I think in companies now, in talent management, you know, lots of companies have had good succession planning in place. What they've not had is good succession management. So people who were going to be ready in a year later were still going to be ready in a year, and they stuck there. So what we're seeing is companies really now focusing on how do we identify our talent, how do we identify what their shortfalls are, and what are we actually going to do to fix that? Because, A, that's going to strengthen the business, but much more, it's likely to be part of the equation of keeping people. You know, lots of people now are very motivated by development and opportunities for challenge.
Nice. The I want to get your take on what we get right and what you feel like we get wrong with performance management.
We've only got 30 minutes, Bill.
Point taken.
Okay. Yeah.
Maybe the one or two things.
Right. Of course, we need to have episodic assessments. We need to have, you know, reviews of performance. But most companies that put in performance management processes, they're not performance management processes. You know, the concept that you can have an annual or even a biannual or quarterly planning process, and that as a result of some episodic review, you're going to significantly influence performance. I mean, I refer to that, frankly, as the flat earth theory. You know, that hasn't been true for decades. You know, I ask senior executives, when was the last time you changed one of your children's behavior as a result of a one-hour discussion and pinning a summary on the bedroom door? And they laugh. And I say, so why do you think it's going to work with your direct reports then? So we've got to understand that performance management is it's a continuous process. We need to equip people with the skills to do that. We need to use technology. We need to support the fact that in many companies, what employees do is not now a direct hierarchical issue. We have matrix structures. We work on projects. We meet people in the corridor. We identify priorities. We agree to do things. So where we're going fundamentally wrong is we are believing that an episodic process that's necessary for statutory purposes, pay and grading and so on, is actually changing performance. The way performance is changed is through those hundreds and perhaps even thousands of interactions, many of them through text messages, many of them through emails. We've got to equip managers with the skills to use those. I often call it conversations with a purpose. And we've got to use technology to drive and underpin and support and enable that. So it's got to become a much richer process. And many companies are starting to do that, but it's relatively rare that you find a company that's actually got it well in place at the moment.
Nice. I'm on record as saying that a talent doesn't really need your feedback per se. So I have a very pointed view about feedback and the levels of talent. So I want to get your take, and I'm wrong about every fifth idea that I have, so I'm often wrong. So I don't mind critical feedback. But I want to get your
give
take.
Me four more then, Bill, because I think you're right on this one.
So what's your take on the different types of talent and what their requisite feedback looks like? What do they need? What is a B talent person? What do they need? And is that different from A talent, et cetera?
Okay. Great question, and it probably links back to the previous one. excuse me. Firstly, I think in one of the other things that HR does wrong, which was your previous question, is we confuse simplicity with ease. I believe we are awfully guilty of trivializing many processes, and one of them is the process used by many organizations for determining genuine performance and measuring potential. You can measure potential, but you have to put the effort in to measure it at an elemental level. And if you do that, I believe it is possible to be very clear about who the A talent are and the extent to which that talent can be deployed. I also believe that you're right, that the top talent is going to succeed despite you, not because of you. And our real requirement in organizations is to identify that, let's call it 20% of employees, who are not quite the top talent, but they're the talent that the top talent breeds off of. Top talent needs an engine. Top talent's the driver, it's the visionary, that's the people who take the lead. But they need an engine behind them that's actually going to deliver on their strategy, their ideas, etc. So to me, the real skill of an organization is identifying very, very accurately their top talent and that next layer, and actually putting emphasis on driving that next layer. Now, that doesn't mean to say you ignore the top talent. You ask, what do they need? What they need is they want challenge, they want opportunity, and they want to have caliber people with whom they can work. Not necessarily quite their caliber, but certainly they want good quality people who are going to help them make the organization successful. And I think we've got to stop trivializing this process. We're going to use a nine box, we're going to stick people in this role, and we're going to have a group of people sitting around and they're going to agree who the top talent is. Let's start getting serious about this. Let's measure potential, let's measure the dimensions, let's get those classifications correct, and then let's really put in place some processes and hold people accountable for delivering them so that we maximize the return we get on those people.
What do you think about the concept of kind of a highly personalized performance management or feedback? Meaning, it's kind of like learning styles. I'm a visual learner. So regardless of kind of where you fit on the strata, maybe I just like feedback a certain way, or I like, performance goals a certain way. Can an organization, and should an organization, create, instead of out of the box one way to deal with talent and performance and feedback, should it be highly personalized?
I think a lot of our processes have got to be highly personalized, and frankly, technology these days enables it. I think we are probably near the peak of the standardized, commoditized SaaS cloud solutions. I think they've been phenomenal in the added value they've brought to organizations, but I think we're now about to move into the next era, which is where we start tailoring to fit organizations and we tailor to fit people. We are a provider of performance management. We're also a provider of 360, but I don't believe that one size fits all. I'm on record, and this is politically correct, Bill, you may have to beep this out, but I don't believe you make ugly people pretty just by giving them mirrors. And my fear is that in many organizations, again, we trivialize. We have a standardized process, we stick people through it, we go, boo, here's your feedback, and we think they're going to change. That's not how it works. You're absolutely right. The individuals have individual needs, the type of jobs they're in have different needs, the timing needs to be different. I think we've got to provide people with tools that enable them to get the feedback they need at the time that they need it. And that's going to be about content, it's going to be about process, and it's going to be about source. And technology now enables you to do that, but we still have this horrible habit of trying to standardize and simplify, which frequently is trivial. You can do very sophisticated things, and for them still to be easy, and clearly then the impact is going to be bigger.
Nice. Why is the word or concept engagement so polarizing? You have people that love it and think that it's the be-all, you have to have it, and you have people that just hate hearing the word, that it's assumptive, that, or maybe even arrogant to think that you can truly engage people, etc. Why in your worldview, when you look at the word engagement, why is it so polarizing?
I think, frankly, Bill, because there's such a wide range of solutions, engagement has really sort of become, the current equivalent of what total quality became in the 80s, where, anybody out there, selling a product calls it engagement and so on. And I've seen such a wide range of content. We've worked ourselves on engagement for many years under previous names, but we researched it, and in fact we now actually partner with two other organisations because of the quality of the content they've got. And I think the people who are anti frequently have had bad experiences. They've had employee opinion surveys which are really sort of happy surveys, and as a consequence, they've seen money spent on so-called engagement not producing a bottom-line return on investment. But if you measure the right things and you do it in the right way, and to some extent it comes back to a point you just made, in my opinion, real quality engagement research within an organization doesn't just look at the top line things about what's the employee feeling about things. It also looks at the importance of those things and how relevant they are to direct impact on the bottom line. So if you look at companies who are very pro-engagement, what you'll typically find is two or three characteristics. Number one, they're measuring factors where you can demonstrate that they correlate directly with improved productivity, improve sustainable performance, and improve discretionary performance. Secondly, you'll see that they are measuring that impact. And thirdly, the surveys they do are the start of the process, not the end of it. And I think that's what you see. You see the polarized organizations are the ones that are doing the happy surveys, not really linking it directly to business performance, and have relatively poor follow-through. The really pro ones, frankly, are being driven by bottom line impact, and you can actually measure, the bottom line effect of engagement if you do it properly.
Nice. Generations. Is it overhyped, or are there real differences from a performance and/or feedback perspective?
Sorry, I didn't catch the beginning of that, Bill. I apologize.
Generations. There's a lot of people that talk about the different generations, and I want to kind of get to the heart of, do you feel like that's all just overhyped, people are people and generations are generations, or do you feel like there's some real differences in the generations from a performance and feedback perspective?
Yeah. Okay, it's a good question. One of the things you have to understand about HR is we're dealing with people, and people need new things. People need change. People get bored. Machines don't get bored. People do. So as a consequence, people who are not in the HR profession often look at HR and go, they're coming out with a new initiative. They're repackaging something. They're putting a bow on something that we did when we were young. The reality is that's a necessity in HR. In order to retain attention, keep people's attention, motivate change and drive it, we have to introduce new concepts, new ideas, new languages. And my view is that what we're doing is we're using generation as a label. We're using it as a language. I don't believe it's so much the generation that's the issue. I think it's what's actually happening in the socioeconomic environment. I meet people who are in their 80s who are incredibly innovative, highly technically savvy, and I meet people in their 20s who are still technophobic. We've got this view that, you know, that it's the generation thing. What I think we've seen is we have seen over the last few years some fundamental changes in the tools that business has, in the technology it uses, in the way in which people communicate. It just happens to correlate with a generation. So, and my belief is that if we're really going to understand these things, we can use those labels, if we like, to communicate. But I think we've got to get much better at articulating what the change actually is. And we're seeing these changes not because it's the next generation. We're seeing the changes because of very, very specific things. Change in the role of capitalism and the way in which people view it. Changes in the way in which businesses are funded and the way in which money is transferred across national boundaries. Changes in the way the political structure works and the way it influences corporate strategy. Changes in the way technology enables the assembly of quality data and the presentation of that for decision making. And changes in the way technology is used to engineer behavior. And don't misunderstand, we are genuinely now in an era where technology is actually engineering behavior, not management. And it's a fundamental shift. So I definitely believe we're seeing the changes, but I don't think it's generational. I think it's actually some of those other things. Generations is just a way of describing or labeling them.
Nice. Tips or tricks that you give people, customers and otherwise, to unlock what I believe is the secret of all secrets, that discretionary effort that employees can either choose to give or not. But is there any wisdom or tips or tricks that you can give folks that helps them unlock that discretionary effort?
Absolutely. I believe there are three. If I was to select, I'd select three things. Number one, I'm a passionate supporter of Dr. Paul Marciano, who wrote the book Carrots and Sticks Don't Work, that respect is a fundamental driver for discretionary performance. People have to respect the company they work for, they have to respect the leadership, they have to respect the manager they work for, the peers or the team within which they work, and they have to feel respected within the organization. So my first tip for a manager is, how do you ensure that those dimensions of respect are in place? Now, we say, that's about good management and good communication. Absolutely, this is not rocket science, but people understand the concept of respect once you describe it to them. Number two, we've got to stop treating people like people and start treating people like individuals. A manager does not have 10 direct reports. A manager has individuals with names of Fred and Jack and Julie and whatever, and each of those will have quite unique profiles in terms of what their expectations, what their requirements are. We've got to teach managers to view people as individuals, and it's relatively easy to diagnose what people want. Some people need feedback. Some people need direction. Some people need support. Some people need lots of attention. Some people want space. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is we've got to teach managers that it's the hundreds of interactions they have with people that matter, not the policy and the procedure and not the annual appraisal. When you bump into someone at a water cooler and you have a five-sentence conversation, you make a huge impact on that person. The trick of a manager is to understand that, to plan it, and to affect it well. And if you teach managers to do that, the discretionary performance that you can achieve is huge. You teach them that annual planning, quarterly performance review, and a formal feedback process will change performance, and frankly, you're lying to them because it doesn't work.
Nice. What's your take on the relationship between culture and/or values? and feedback.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, you know, culture and values. My view there is culture is what you get as a result of people displaying their values. And you know, the one thing I've noticed, Bill, over the years is the test of an organization's values is not, you know, do they have the posters up? Did they have the focus groups and the town hall meetings? And even do their procedures theoretically match their values? The test of an organization's values is what happens when things go wrong. You know, so we've seen many organizations, and I think this is where many companies have lost the respect of their staff, because they had these values, we value people. Yeah, until the profit started to go down. And then what happened? They randomly picked people and got rid of them. You know, they used criteria that the staff didn't understand and were criteria that would that had never been used before. So to me, the first thing you have to look at in an organization is how do its values show themselves when difficulties arise, when projects slip, when profit drops, when client complaints occur, when we struggle with resources. Because ultimately, that's the culture of the organization. The culture is how people act during their working day. And typically, we give feedback to people against the theoretical values. The real challenge is, how do you make them fit? And you know, I've not worked in Zappos, and I don't know how true what the videos are. But if you watch some of the videos about the CEO of Zappos, who says, you know, I'm going to make sure that the people fit how we want this organization to look, you know, I think he's close to understanding what real values and what real culture look like. And my guess is, in that organization, you get feedback that's actually meaningful. Why? Because the feedback matches the behavior of the executive, would be my guess.
Nice. We've got about 3 minutes left in the show, and I told you this would run fast. It's a fascinating conversation. I wish we had another 30 minutes. Last question I've got, and I know that this is on a lot of people's minds, is how do they know when things are working? So specifically, how do they know when their performance systems and process, like how will they know that they've achieved and gotten to a place where they know it's working?
Yeah, I mean, this is the big challenge. I mean, I think HR's got a huge challenge. We went from a period, you know, in the probably the early 90s, where we had relatively little data. You know, then with the help of, you know, some real experts in the field, like, you know, Jack Fritzens and that, we've now got to the point where probably we've got huge amounts of data, probably more than we can cope with. But I think one of the real challenges for organizations is, you know, taking data and turning it into intelligence. And again, I think too often we try to simplify things. We try to look for the, you know, that one or two magic measures. I think as HR, we've got to become much more data literate. We've got to develop the skills of coming up with indices which will measure things. And of course, you've got the profit measure and so on. You've got retention figures and so on. But I think what we've got to be able to do is we've got to get much, much better at being able to measure cause and effect. And typically, we often assume that correlations are cause and effect. We assume that if people are happy, things are good. And if they're not happy, things are bad. If numbers are big, they're good. If numbers are small, they're bad. We've got to develop the skill of taking data, applying various algorithms, computing indices, and genuinely proving that they work. And it's possible to do that. You can actually do that. And it's quite staggering. You can, even with relatively little data, you can even predict the probability of attrition within an organization, sometimes before the people even know they're going to leave themselves. And by combining data about, you know, time and attendance, productivity, recent salary changes, levels of performance, and so on. So I don't think there's a simple answer, but I think it's definitely something that can be done.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of my favorite personalities and minds in this space with Pilat HR, that's PILAT.com. Clinton, thank you for your time today, and everyone, thank you for listening to Drive Through HR. We're going to go out to a little cure. Thanks, everyone.
It's a pleasure to be with you.